Welcome to the For the Reef podcast. Each week we bring our fish nerd conversations from the fish room floor to your living room. We try to bridge the gap between the saltwater aquarium hobby and coral reef conservation. Now, here are your hosts, fisheries biologist and founder of For the Reef Apparel, Mitch Dender, with local fish store owner and first responder, Ian Bell.
Entrance for Steve. He's a really impressive guy and he's very modest, so he'll probably be a little embarrassed by this, but I'm just gonna go ahead and do it.
I think he just took his headphones off.
So Steve is really a world-class conservation scientist joining us today from the Shedd Aquarium. Steve joined the Shedd Aquarium in 2017 to oversee a suite of marine conservation research projects aimed at protecting important species in the Bahamas, including endangered Nassau grouper and threatened queen conch. Steve also leads his original research project to better understand Caribbean shark species in an effort to protect them. He has led and assisted with studies of lemon sharks, red sea sharks, and manta rays, and helped develop conservation management projects for several other species. Steve has a PhD in marine ecology and biology from, I might be saying this wrong, is it Cardiff University?
Yep, Cardiff University in Wales.
So yeah, Cardiff University in the UK. He has spent time in the Cardiff University as a postdoctoral fellow, acting as the principal investigator for the Jupiter Large Coastal Shark Species Study. And this kind of leads into how Steve and I know each other. Steve worked for the University of Windsor's Great Lakes Institute for Environmental Research as the principal investigator for the Lancaster Sound Arctic component of the Ocean Tracking Network. And temporarily during that time, he stepped into the freshwater world where he studied the movements and migrations of lake sturgeon in the Great Lakes and Michigan State University. That pretty much sums it up, Steve.
Yeah, you have to be diverse to kind of make it in this field these days. So, I went from working with sharks in Florida and Jupiter. I was based out of Cardiff University, but really living in Miami and working off the east coast of the U.S., then Nigel Hussey, who's now a professor at the University of Windsor, on his recommendation, I was employed by Dr. Aaron Fisk at the Great Lakes Institute to look at Arctic cod up in the Lancaster Sound. Now, luckily during that time, I managed to keep an interest in sharks because Dr. Nigel Hussey, also with the Ocean Tracking Network, and Dr. Fisk were looking at Greenland sharks. So I was able to kind of tap into that work and help out with that regionally in the area of the Arctic and we were working in. So I still kind of kept that interest in shark species. Then following that, I was trying to find a long-term position, thinking that would be a faculty position at some university, and I realized by that point that my research interests from a passion perspective really lied in the Bahamas, or at least the Caribbean region. I'd been to a conference down in Panama City in Panama for the Caribbean Fisheries Institute, Gulf and Caribbean Fisheries Institute. And going and seeing all those scientists and the work they were doing in the region, I realized that's where my heart really lay from my PhD research, in that region. Right. So I started looking for positions that would allow me to go back there and end up working with lake sturgeon at Michigan State University. But it was a strategic move to try and broaden my research horizons, make myself more broadly employable by biology departments, in the US and Canada and the UK. And while I was doing that, I found this position here at the Shedd Aquarium, which was kind of a perfect fit for me. And I'd never contemplated working at an aquarium. I'd always thought I'd end up in an academic institution. But the job advert, I could have written it myself. It was to live in Chicago, which is, a really fantastic city. Have my office at an aquarium, which is really a dream for any marine biologist or ecologist, and get to do all the research in the Bahamas. So it was a really, really fantastic fit. And that's how I ended up here.
Yeah, like we were talking before we started recording the podcast, it's pretty crazy. Not many researchers, when they're getting stumped on, when they're writing or something, you can just walk out the front door and go for a stroll through the aquarium and find some inspiration.
So yeah, that's absolutely. There's nothing to cure writer's block than staring at some sharks swimming around. And
yeah.
It's not always feasible.
Yeah, it's funny too that you said when you said Greenland shark, I forgot about all that stuff. I think probably one of my most intelligent questions I had for you back when we were at GLEAR together was if Greenland sharks eat polar bears.
So evidence would suggest that they do. There have been polar bear remains found in Greenland shark stomachs. So part of that research group's program that discovered that. Now the big question is, do they scavenge polar bears or do they predate them? That we don't know. We do know that they consume them, but whether or not they, you know, are able to predate them, that's another question.
Yeah, and for me, I was having a bet with one of the other students there, and I think I just lied and said that they do predate them. So hopefully Dilraj isn't listening to the podcast right now.
Well, there's more evidence to suggest they predate things like beluga whales and narwhal, but we don't know. I mean, it's very possible. So
yeah,
I think your bet is valid until proven otherwise.
Yeah.
That sounds, to the guy on the street, it sounds interesting, because whenever you see a Greenland shark in a video or something, it looks like a really slow moving, docile, unoffensive creature. To think of it predating on something just doesn't sort of fit with the image that you're usually shown.
Yeah, and I think that's just because of the nature of greenland sharks. They're often deep, but not always. They will come up into very shallow water to scavenge and potentially predate. But they're in a very remote region of the world, typically. And when they're not in that region, they are typically quite deep, because the surface water is a bit too warm for them. So that's ongoing research by the person I mentioned before, my colleague, Dr. Nigel Hussey, who's kind of trying to get at answering some of those questions or provide evidence for their ability to do that, and watch that space, I guess.
So one of my questions would be, before you guys get into the deep research of it, how am I going to word this? When people think of an aquarium, they think, oh, they're just people working there to make it look nice so we can come see that. How much of that is for viewing and sort of public education, and how much is research based? And is that when someone goes to build an aquarium, is that sort of their primary goal? Like, I'm trying to build a research facility and this aquarium sort of helps fund that? Or how does that sort of work? To give people a better understanding of what aquariums are for?
Yeah, it's a really good question. It's a really interesting perspective I find from people who, when they find out I work at an aquarium and work with sharks, they typically assume that I'm an aquarist working in that aquarium, taking care or even studying the sharks that live at the aquarium. And the broader question about aquariums, it varies a lot from organization to organization. Shedd is one of the oldest aquariums in the US, probably in the continental North America. It was built in 1930, and at one time was the largest aquarium in the world, I believe. And it was not built with research in mind. It was built by the philanthropist John G. Shedd, and it was built as a result of one of the world's fairs, where they had an aquarium exhibit within the fair. He recognized the potential as a public service, really, to the residents of Chicago and also a tourism draw for Chicago as a city. So it really wasn't built with research in mind. But as, you know, time goes on, and the way of the world now is conservation is becoming more and more apparent in every realm of the natural world. And as an aquarium, it's a really, you know, Suzanne Aquariums, it's regularly viewed as almost a responsibility to not only give back, but maintain the habitats of these incredible creatures that, you know, call the Shedd Aquarium home. We do most of our research, our marine research, in the Bahamas, and a lot of the animals over the years that are on display at Shedd Aquarium and live at Shedd Aquarium were collected either in the Florida Keys, but later in the Bahamas. So we kind of have a responsibility to give back to the ecosystems these animals come from and protect those species in the wild. It's a great opportunity for people in Chicago or the Midwest to come to Shedd Aquarium and get to be face to face with animals that they otherwise very unlikely to have the opportunity to see in the wild. And a lot of people would never be able to afford to. It's very expensive, you know, to travel around the world. It's a dream of many people, but not a reality for everyone. So being able to benefit from having a really fantastic facility providing really great habitats for these creatures and keeping them, you know, very content in Chicago, we really need to offset that by giving back to the natural world. But Shedd Aquariums are non-profit. Not all aquariums are non-profits, but a lot of them are. We have one of the larger research departments of aquariums in the US. I think most of the newer built aquariums try and build that in, and there's a bigger push by the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, who oversee all the zoos and aquariums in the UK, or the ones that are registered to AZA. That means they have been assessed by AZA and accredited by AZA, which means they are, you know, following good practices, good animal welfare, good animal health, etc. And there's a push from them as well to, you know, that conservation is really becoming a primary, research and conservation is becoming a primary goal of these aquariums, along with, of course, education. Yeah. Mm. Two of our biggest outlays from our revenue at the aquarium is education and research at the moment.
Oh, that's good. I've had a chance to go to the Shedd Aquarium. It was probably 20 years ago, but when this COVID mess is over, I highly recommend everybody goes, because it's a really nice setting right on the lake there. You if you didn't know where you were, you'd almost fool yourself into thinking you're at the ocean. There's the creatures, you know, it's a really nice area.
No, as I say, it's one of the oldest aquariums in the US, but it's definitely kept up with modern times, and some of the newer habitats are really, really fantastic, and the historic galleries are great too. The architecture itself is mind-blowing. It's all terracotta. It was built in the same kind of rock as the Field Museum across the campus there, and it's a really beautiful building, really fantastic animals that live there, and ones, as we said, that otherwise people would probably not get the opportunity to see in this region.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think last time I was there, it might have been I don't know, 6 years ago was the last time I was there. I think there was a coral exhibit like in the basement or something, right? Is there a coral reef tank there?
So we have, you know, I'm not the best person to talk about this. You know, I work there, but my research, my main focus is in the field, in the wild. I don't have a lot to do with, you know, taking care of the animals there. If anything, all I really do from that perspective is currently once a week I go and help dive the shark tank to maintain the habitat.
Just once a week I go dive with sharks. No big
deal. Yeah. Well, no, I'm not. Yeah. Normally I used to do it once a month, but with COVID and we lost a lot of our volunteers. I don't mean lost them to the virus. I mean the restrictions associated with having to shut the aquarium meant that our huge volunteer base of very capable divers were not able to come and assist. Mm-hmm. And as such, our aquarists became very, very overwhelmed with the workload. So I kind of upped my regularity to go in. And that's really great opportunity. It's a really nice thing to do. And you know, there's not many places in the Midwest, if any, that you can go and get to swim around with sharks and clean some of the habitat. But I like that kind of, I like that manual labor. I don't get to do it all that often. So it's really nice to get back in there. But in our bigger shark habitat, which is in the basement, we don't have any live coral in that habitat. It's a very large, it's about 400,000 gallons. And you know, it's got a fair few fish in there, Lesmobranchs, very sensitive. And trying to kind of maintain coral health in that larger habitat would be, you know, counterproductive, I think. Oh, yeah. Within the actual wild reef exhibit itself, which is one of the newer, bar in our roll-in exhibit, which is currently underwater beauty, it's the newest part of the aquarium. I think it was built in the 90s. There are some really nice live coral habitats. There's one with the giant clam that's got some really beautiful corals in there, some with some really beautiful filefishes. But it's not the only place we have live corals in the aquarium, in some of the historic galleries. And in between them, we have some more of the Caribbean species. And a lot of those corals that people don't realize are corals that were confiscated by TSA and customs at O'Hare Airport. And then obviously they confiscate because they're being illegally traded or transported. And they need someone to take care of them, and they end up coming to us. But it's not great that they've been, illegally transported, but it's nice that they have an endpoint when that happens.
They do that here too. If they're taken at Toronto, they're given to the Ripley's Aquarium there.
Yeah. Because of that, we have a very wide range of corals from across the world, but a lot of the larger habitats, the coral structure is quite convincing, but artificial.
Mm-hmm. So what are you working on right now? What's kind of like the main research focus for you right now?
So my role at the aquarium, I oversee the marine research program. We have two wings to we have a conservation research program. We have the VP of conservation research, my boss, Dr. Chuck Knapp. He has his own independent research project on endemic iguana species in the Bahamas that he's been doing since the 1990s. And that's how a lot of our very strong relationships with the government and nonprofits in the Bahamas come from his long research history there. We have a strong working relationship with the Bahamas National Trust, who oversee all the marine parks and national park, terrestrial national parks in the Bahamas. They're a nonprofit. And then we have a very good working relationship with the Department of Marine Resources, who set a lot of the fisheries management for the Bahamas. As I said, we also have an entire freshwater wing that focuses on habitats around the Great Lakes, around Chicago and further afield, urban ecosystems, migratory fish, even freshwater mussels. And that's led by my counterpart, Dr. Karen Murchie. And then on the marine side, I oversee a suite of programs, my own personal program, which is focused on sharks and rays in the Bahamas. That we then have a mesopredator biologist, Dr. Lynn Waterhouse. She's focusing mainly at the moment on Nassau grouper, but not exclusively. The plan is to expand out to other grouper and snapper species. We then have an invertebrate biologist, Dr. Andrew Cowell. He looks particularly at queen conch and lobster, two of the most commercially and culturally important species in the Bahamas. So both from an economic perspective in terms of commercial fisheries with the mesopredators and the invertebrates, the conch and the lobster. We also look at other economically important species, that being the sharks that are not commercially fished in the Bahamas, and corals. And we have a very incredible coral reef biologist, which I'm sure you guys would be most interested in, and hopefully you guys will get to talk to him at some point. That being Dr. Ross Cunningham. He's a really great guy. He's a very up and coming young coral biologist, but very quickly becoming very renowned within the field. His program focuses on working with restoration, but also identifying heat tolerant strains of coral and ways in which we can do that with the idea of improving the success of restoration efforts going forward. So if we can identify heat tolerant genetic strains, we can focus a little more effort on using those for the restoration efforts with the idea that in a warming ocean, they'll have a better chance of survival into the future.
Yeah, it'd be really interesting to have him and Aaron together.
Oh yeah, I was thinking that when
and
I was
sort of talk to... about, because the Aaron's methodologies are a little bit different than a lot of the programs going on around. He'd probably be an interesting addition to that conversation.
Yeah. So overall, our programs collectively focus, as I say, on economically important species. Some economically important because they have a direct commercial value to the Bahamian economy. Others such as shark and coral, they have a couple of different importances. One is just ecosystem health, which in turn helps support sustainable fisheries. Coral at the base, sharks more at the kind of top. And that way we can look at ecosystem processes in the long term. It's an ecosystem approach. We have, you know, all the way from sharks at the top to, you know, the reef builders at the bottom being the coral and also good trophic levels in between. And those sharks and those corals, they have a big economic value for tourism. For sharks, for example, sure. The Bahamas is often described as the shark dive capital of the world. It's estimated that tourism and associated revenue purely of that shark dive tourism is worth around $113 million to the Bahamian economy every year.
So what kind of sharks, what would you say are like the kind of iconic shark species that you guys see in the Bahamas?
In the Bahamas, there's a lot of species. Sharks have been well protected in the Bahamas for many years. So in 2011, the Bahamas designated their waters as a shark sanctuary, and that made it illegal to harvest or kill a shark anywhere within Bahamian national waters. And that's an area of around 630,000 square kilometers of the Northwest Atlantic that's now a real safe haven for shark species. And they didn't do that. They didn't introduce that management strategy because the shark populations were collapsing like they are in many places around the world. They did it because they did have healthy shark populations and they wanted to protect them. They, you know, recognize they're very progressive with their shark conservation management. It should really be applauded. They've done an amazing job. And they recognize the value both from tourism and also ecosystem health of those shark populations. one of the reasons they were already so healthy is long before that, in 1993, they banned the use of longline and gillnet in commercial fishing techniques, or in any even artisanal fishing. You're not allowed to use longline gillnet, and they're two of the most destructive fishing gears for sharks, whether they're being used to target sharks or target other things like tuna or snapper. Sharks will be caught in high abundance on those two fishing gears as a bycatch, and they'll likely die anyway. Now, to flip that, we do use gillnets and long lines for scientific research, but we're able to manipulate the gear or set up the gear in such a way that it's catch and release, and we don't have those very high levels of mortality. Mm-hmm. But it was really those management initiatives in the Bahamas that have meant that I'd say the Bahamas are some of the healthiest, if not the healthiest, shark populations in the Northwest Atlantic. And really, the biodiversity is equally as impressive. The Shed Shark Program has been running for about 3 years now, and I believe we have interacted with, from a research perspective, I'm trying to think now, between the long lines, the video, and the video surveys, and all the other different techniques we use to study them, we're probably looking at about 11 different species of shark. No, I'm forgetting the deep water species. We also do deep water research. That's probably going to push it to about 17 different species of shark. But you know, there's probably somewhere in the region of who knows how many deep sea species are down there in the deep habitats in the Bahamas that haven't even been described yet. But I hazard a guess at somewhere around a total species diversity of somewhere in the region of about 45 different species of sharks. And some of the big names that you'd likely be familiar with would be tiger sharks, hammerheads, bull sharks. They're three species that are quite abundant in the Bahamas, especially relative to other areas of the Caribbean where sharks are fished. But beyond that, Caribbean reef sharks, black nose sharks, lemon sharks is what my PhD research focused on. I dare say black nose, sharp nose, and then we're starting to get into some of the deeper water species as well. But they're all species, black tip sharks, all species you can see pretty reliably and regularly in the Bahamas, which is why it's such a big draw for shark dive enthusiasts.
What depth are you? Sorry, go ahead, Ian.
No, go ahead there. You got a little blurry.
I was just thinking at what depth are you kind of talking about when you talk about deep sea sharks?
Well, everything below that resides, predominantly or regularly below 250 meters is considered a deep sea shark. Which is a good chunk of the shark species out there. There's a paper by Grubbs et al. That estimate, I think it was somewhere, I can't remember the numbers exactly off the top of my head, but I think around 42 or 47 species of sharks or chondrichthyan fishes are considered or classified as deep sea sharks. Yet only 7% of the published literature on sharks is focused on that group, the deep sea sharks. For a similar reason of that, there's a little research on the Greenland sharks. They're in a remote area, often deep when they're not. It's trickier. It's harder to do research in the deep ocean.
And how successful do you think that these, so for example, when they make kind of a shark conservation area within the Bahamas, are these sharks migrating out and then they're kind of putting themselves at risk, or how successful is that kind of thing?
Yeah, it's a good question. And it's true. It's, you can argue that for any marine protected area, any spatially focused conservation technique for any marine creature or terrestrial, its success is going to be completely defined by the spatial level of that species movement. So how well it protects any given species will depend on the size or the scope or the designation of that area relative to their movements over the course of a day, a month, a year, say. And that's actually what a lot of my work focuses on here. I kind of specialize in spatial ecology, so looking at the movements and migrations of sharks and rays and how that relates to management in the Bahamas. So because of the extreme expanse of the Bahamas, for a lot of species, it's going to do a very good job. One of the main species I've been focusing my research on is the Caribbean reef shark. It's a shark that's quite abundant in the Bahamas, but almost extinct from many other areas within the broader Caribbean. And it's a real safehold for this species that's very threatened in other parts. And looking at their movements and migration, they seem quite sight attached. They're called a reef shark, and they are very well named because they are very reef associated. They don't seem to have huge home ranges, and their largest movements seem to be, once they establish that home range, their largest movements seem to be associated with reproduction. So potentially to mate or even to go and pup. We don't have a clear understanding of where they go to pup. So when I was in Bimini, we had a very reliable spot. We would take volunteers, film crews, if they wanted to see, you know, sharks where we knew there'd be a lot of reef sharks. And we would be guaranteed to see a good amount of reef sharks every single time we went to this spot. It was called Triangle Rocks. And then 2 weeks of the year, of course, typically when we had a film crew with us, they'd all be gone. There wouldn't be a single one there. And where they went, we didn't know. We haven't even figured out yet. But that's some of the work. But for other species, like say a tiger, some of the other ones I mentioned, like a tiger shark, a hammerhead, or even a bull shark, tiger sharks in particular are highly migratory. And at least some individuals make movements out into the mid-Atlantic Ocean, you know, up and down the US coast. And as they move over these huge distances, I mean, we're talking about thousands and thousands of kilometers, maybe over the course of a year, they're subject to different levels of threat. You know, if they're in the Bahamas, they're pretty safe. You know, some of the high seas of the Bahamas, it's impossible for the Bahamas to effectively marshal those areas. And you know, they say the high seas is like the Wild West. It's technically illegal, but I'm sure there's a lot of illegal fishing in the high seas, you know, out in the deep water of the Atlantic that is taking sharks in Bahamian waters at times of the year. But if they're around the islands, if they're staying shallow and coastal, they're pretty well protected. You know, then if they swim over to Florida, they're also protected in Florida state waters, but that's only from 0 to 3 miles from shore. So once they swim up, you know, the East Coast or into parts of the Gulf of Mexico or wider Atlantic, they are susceptible. But that doesn't mean there's no worth for tiger sharks for, say, the Bahamas shark sanctuary, because they're spending quite a lot of time in the Bahamas, and during that time, they're protected. So it's decreasing their overall risk of being harvested.
And then how are you tracking them? Like what the equipment and that kind of thing?
So it was the same exact kind of techniques I was using up in the Arctic, mainly for the Arctic cod, but working with Nigel Wood and the greening sharks. There's two main ways we use to track sharks, one being acoustic telemetry and the other being satellite telemetry. They're different and the different pros and cons, and it's sometimes used in tandem, we get the best picture of what's going on. Acoustic telemetry, the type I mainly use, we sometimes refer to as passive acoustic telemetry, is very good because you get very high retention of the transmitters up to 10 years or beyond. We typically implant the transmitters into the body cavity of the shark because the batteries are so long on them, they last about 10 years. If you attach them externally, you typically only get about a 2 month retention. If you implant them, it's almost indefinite.
So like externally to the dorsal fin or something like that?
Yeah, you can attach it to the, you know, dorsal musculature or through the dorsal fin. There's lots of different attachment methods have been used over the years. But as I say, you're typically going to get a low retention of that piece of research equipment. And since the batteries do last so long, and since the lifespan of these sharks are so long, and also often the ontogenetic change in their spatial behavior as they kind of go from a juvenile to a subadult to adult is quite diverse. To really understand their movements and how best to protect them, you need to track them over multiple years. Like a month of tracking data is typically not going to be enough. If you tracked a tiger shark in the Bahamas for a month, you might say it had a home range of, I don't know, it could be like 50 square miles. Whereas if you, you know, track it over the course of 10 years, it could be 50,000 square miles. I don't know. Maybe that's a bit ambitious. No, it could be way more than that. It could be way more than 50,000 square miles. You know, as I say, linearly, they can travel thousands and thousands of kilometers in a given year. So really understanding sharks, you need to track them over long, long periods of time, whether they are resident or not, or if they're highly migratory, you're not going to find out on a short duration track. The problem with acoustic telemetry is it is typically archival, and it relies on the establishment of acoustic receiver stations around a given study area. And the shark can only be detected when it's in acoustic range of a given receiver, you know, a setup station. And that can be anything, you know, that can be 10 meters to 2 kilometers, depending on the water body, the conditions. It is variable, but we have ways to truth for that. Now, it's in a sense cheaper than satellite telemetry. The tags cost around $300-$350 per tag, and the receivers cost somewhere between $1,500 to $2,000 per unit. But it's still, it's not cheap, you know, it's not cheap, it's just cheaper. The way we kind of get around that a little bit, in the sense of, say I'm trying to look at the movements of tiger sharks and I can afford 20 receivers, and I have, well, in the Bahamas right now, I think I have about 38 in our total array. So I've got 38 receivers scattered around the Bahamas. But you know, I don't know where that shark's gonna go. And if it goes somewhere I don't expect it to go, or would never think it would go, I'm not really gonna detect it, because I've only put my receivers in these locations where I think it makes the most sense, you know, whether that be a big grid or at choke points or whatever that might be. This is how I best think, but it could swim somewhere completely different and I'd never ever know, because it's not gonna be detected.
Right, so that's where the satellite tags would come in. Is that the
idea? In a sense, but the way we get around that more broadly in acoustic telemetry is, what's really cool about the technology, as long as you use the same brand of, there's several different brands, but one of them, I won't say the brand because, you know, we have to be diplomatic on here or whatever the word is. But it's a Canadian brand, which is very cool. And they are probably, I don't know, 80% of people, researchers are using that brand. That might be an over exaggeration, but a lot of them, the majority of researchers use this one brand. And what's great is my receiver can detect anyone's tag, and their receiver can detect my tag. So my sharks that I've tagged, anyone doing a study on anything, it's not just sharks, it could be sea turtles, it could be tiny little fish, you know, they use them a lot for salmon, you know, they use them in freshwater, in marine water, in every, they can be used in any aquatic environment, given certain limitations. So there's hundreds of researchers across the globe using these different technologies, using the same technology. So all up and down the East Coast is scattered with these receivers. So if I tag a tiger shark and I could detect it for a while on my area in the Bahamas, well, it might swim to another area of the Bahamas, but there could be someone else over there studying a different shark species, studying snapper, and they're going to detect it over there. And then once it hits the US East Coast, it's going to be detected as it swims up and down the coast. And there's a whole array in the Gulf of Mexico. So by having those research collaborative lines of communication, we call them network groups, we're able to exchange data and really maximize the output of these implanted transmitters, which is great.
Yeah, that seems like a great way to kind of share. I mean, it almost seems like in everything, and especially in research and in conservation, it's the more that we share the knowledge and the resources and everything, it's like a net gain for everyone, and of course for the animals.
Absolutely, and it's not only a benefit, it's essential at this point. You know, we're really, with conservation, in most areas of conservation, we're so far behind the eight ball, we're so late to the party with a lot of it, and it's a real uphill struggle. I feel really, as a scientist, you know, even in the, over the course of my career, which is, you know, about 18 years, I've seen a change in attitude about data sharing and working together and being collaborative, because there's been a realization that it's the only way we're going to get on top of this stuff or even make any headway in some of these conservation issues, is to be as open and collaborative as possible. If we're trying to compete against each other for resources and for accolade, nobody's winning there. Right. We really all need to work together to try and, you know, push the needle in the right direction and make headway in some of these conservation issues. And that is a good, in my field, obviously that's the best example I can give, is with these acoustic telemetry networks. Another good example is in the genetic field, how they're sharing and making it publicly available.
And I'm sure that's the same for, I know with human trials and everything like that, it's really expensive. So they share everything, because it gets so costly, especially, you know, everything with going on with COVID.
But, you'd like to think so, you know, with Big Pharma, I feel like there's probably still a
little
cloak and dagger there because of the potential financial gains. But you know, most conservation scientists, research scientists are not in it for the money. They're really in it for making a difference. So that's where there's that kind of different attitude. So on the one hand, you have the acoustic telemetry with these fantastic network groups and a lot of data sharing. And then the other technique is satellite telemetry, which there's several different types, but the main two are either tags that are attached to the top of the dorsal fin of the shark, and they rely on the shark coming to the surface and that tag transmitting to satellites to get locations. And then there's others that are archival. So they're attached typically at the base of the dorsal fin with a dart, and they record, they archive vertical movement data and temperature data. And after a preset period of time, they pop off, float to the surface, and then transmit as much of that data as they can until the batteries run out. So that's the kind of two main ways we look at shark movements.
And Steve, I think that there was like a, there's some information that you put on those tracking devices so that if some, you know, someone randomly finds them on the beach, they can pick it up and call in or something like that, right? On
a lot of those. So for those externally attached ones, we normally put our contact information on there. And the reason we do that is if we get them back, we get a lot higher resolution data. And there was a really cute incident. So I had, it was the kind of nicest public interaction I've had during my research career, where one of the tags I put on the sharks in Jupiter in Florida washed up on a beach in, I think it was South Carolina. And it was discovered by a four-year-old child who was beach combing. And his mum wrote me the sweetest email saying how he's always dreamt of becoming a marine biologist, and he's going to take his reward money and put it to his college fund to become a marine biologist.
Oh, awesome.
Oh, that's cool.
Really, really nice. Yeah. And then I sent them the information on the shark that we'd attached a tag to, and I think it was about 2.43-meter lemon shark. Wow. And she sent me back a photo of the kid and his twin brother laid out on a drawing of the shark that they'd drawn on some like packing paper. It was really sweet.
Awesome. Yeah, it's cool. Like, I'm sure, you know, with you doing this stuff all day long, you know, and you get kind of caught. I mean, even in my little bit of time out in BC doing the salmon stuff, I look back on those memories of doing research and that kind of stuff, and you know, you sometimes have to be reminded of how cool your job is. And so I'm sure you have those moments every once in a while where you're like, man, this is pretty cool to be out here studying sharks, eh?
Yeah, because to the rest of us, pretty much everything you do is freaking awesome. But from your point of view, what have you stumbled across in your, you know, recent past that amazed you?
I mean,
what amazes the shark researcher?
You know, like my old mentor, Dr. Samuel Gruber, he passed about a year and a half ago. And I was in the field with him one day about 10 years ago, and he must have been about in his 70s then, or at least late 60s. And we caught this really cool big lemon shark that we tagged, and it was this really big, beautiful shark. And he was so excited. It was like seeing a child who'd seen their first ever shark, and he was yelping and giggling, and it went away, and he was so excited we tagged it. And he just turned to me and said, you know what, this never gets boring. And I often think about that when I'm in the field. You know, we spend a lot of time on our computers. The reality of our job is we spend more time analyzing the data and writing papers than we do hands-on in the field with sharks. But being so privileged to get to go to the, you know, the far reaches of the Bahamas and the world sometimes and see these incredible aquatic ecosystems and animals that I never dreamt that would be a reality as a kid. I don't think I will ever lose sight of how privileged I am to get to do that.
So you were saying earlier that there's up to 45 species in your area. Which species have you come across and tagged or counted, or however you want to describe it, that you've gone, wow, I never thought I'd see one of these?
You know, a lot of them, the first time I saw any of them was a real delight, you know, regardless of what that species was, whether that be a nurse shark. I remember that when I first went to, as an undergrad at a university, I had the opportunity to go and do what they called a year in industry. And I went out to the shark lab in Bimini, the Bimini Biological Field Station, which became this study place for my PhD. I remember this is going to really show my age, but I had a disposable underwater camera, and I'm a terrible photographer. And on the first day, I burnt a whole roll over the side of the boat, taking a photograph of a stingray, a southern stingray, which I proceeded to see like 30 of every single day for the rest of the trip. And I did become a little jaded by then. But the first time you see a new species, regardless of what that was, sharks and, you know, any marine creature, it's a special thing. But, you know, some of the really, really big tiger sharks I've come across, when they're any shark, you know, big, huge hammerheads, you know, hammerheads pushing 14 feet, great hammerheads, tiger sharks, you know, possibly even bigger than that. So the deep sea species are fascinating, because there's some that not only have I never seen one before, but a lot of people have never seen at all. So some of those species are really amazing to see. And I'm hoping, you know, fingers crossed, that as we increase our deep water element of the research, we'll hopefully discover a new species at some point.
I want to circle back to the conservation stuff you were talking about earlier. You were talking about long lines and gill nets being a large issue. The other one that people always hear about is shark finning. Do you think we're making any headway with that? Do you think that that is getting better, or do you think it's still a huge problem?
I mean, it's definitely still a huge problem. Whether we're making headway or not, I'd like to think so. I've felt for a while now it's going to be a generational thing. It's going to be tricky to change the habits of the current generation, which is where the shark fin soup demand is coming from. But I do believe that, you know, between research and conservation organizations, there's a lot of really great nonprofits that focus on educating youth, and not just, you know, in the Western world, but also in areas where shark fin soup is consumed regularly. And I do believe that we are making some headway, and that the next generation will have a different outlook on the consumption of shark fin soup, at least to the level that it has been previously consumed. You know, I was involved in a study about 10 years ago now, where we estimated that around 100 million sharks killed in commercial fisheries every year. And we did that for the year 2002 and 2010, and the amount was pretty similar. You know, the estimates were pretty similar. So over that decadal period, it didn't seem like there'd been a lot of progress. But I'd like to think that, you know, we are making some progress. I mean, we have to believe that. Otherwise, it's pointless. But no, I do believe that we're very slowly starting to make some headway, and there's a lot of horror stories out there about collapses of shark populations and fisheries, et cetera. But there are a lot of very positive stories about conservation successes, and they're what we really need to focus on and learn from our past experiences, and what conservation measures have worked, what haven't worked. And the more information we get, the more research we do, the better we'll be able to conserve and protect sharks, and the better chance some of those populations or those species that are heavily declined will have to recover.
Hmm. The other question I had real quick is, I've only ever been able to run into one shark. I wish I'd seen more, but I've seen one, so it pales in comparison. But when I was diving with that, the local guide found some lionfish. He chopped them up and he left them. In theory, he thought he was, you know, teaching them to predate on the sharks, or predate on the lionfish. Yeah. So being that your research is based in the Caribbean, I figured you'd be the perfect person to ask. Being that the lionfish is invasive to the Caribbean, are you seeing, people like to think that they're going to try and get sharks to eat these things. Are you seeing that become part of the diet of some species?
I haven't personally observed a shark naturally predate a lionfish, and my current research is not looking as heavily as some of the past research I was involved with on shark diet. I'd imagine there's some studies out there currently going on that might, where those researchers will maybe be able to give you a clearer answer. What I will say is, I was in the Bahamas when lionfish first appeared. They're still there. I get to go to a lot of places around the Bahamas, and I can't believe I haven't mentioned this till now. The way I'm able to do that is that Shedd Aquarium is very unique in that it has a very large 80-foot research vessel, liverboard research vessel.
Very nice.
And that's how we are, you know, we are based in Chicago and able to do all our work down in the Bahamas. It's called the RV Coral Reef 2. It's a really incredible boat. It's normally the first thing I talk about because I'm so in love with it and I can't believe it took this long to bring it up. We get to go to a lot of places around the Bahamas, and I remember seeing my first lionfish. I remember them being a lot more abundant when I left the Bahamas after my PhD. When I went back, they were absolutely everywhere at a very alarming rate, and now they're a lot more in balance. There's a lot of, you know, lionfish kill tournaments, hunting tournaments that maybe have made had some influence on, you know, controlling the levels. But really what I believe has happened is they kind of come into a greater balance with the ecosystem. Now, likely sharks are consuming them. And I think some of the bigger group are a real predator of the lionfish, particularly when they're smaller. And what I've noticed is in the marine parks, the Notate Marine Reserves in the Bahamas, particularly in the Exuma Keys Land and Sea Park, which is very effectively patrolled by the Bahamas National Trust, and it's a very functional marine park. You see very, very few lionfish. And in these parks, you also see a lot of sharks and a lot of big meso predators, a lot of big grouper, a lot of big snapper, the kind of things that would naturally eat the lionfish. I think it's a combination of all of those mid to high level predators figuring out that the lionfish is something they can eat and how to hunt them. And thankfully, we have seen them, you know, they're not going anywhere. Lionfish are never going to not be in the Caribbean now. And fortunately, they're quite pretty. Obviously, they did have a quite negative ecological impact, but I hope that it wasn't so terminal that we lost native fish in place of these. But I'm kind of confident that they're coming into balance, and that's a very good thing.
That's encouraging.
Yeah, to kind of give like another fun example that I was thinking of when he was talking about that was with the, you might have heard of the round goby that are around the Great Lakes and everything. I mean, seems like another story where when they were first introduced in this area, how fast that they were moving around and being aggressive and taking habitat from darters and smaller fish, bait fish species. But it almost feels like they are starting to, you know, similar to what you're saying with the lionfish, they seem like they're like finding a role within this ecosystem, and they're kind of like a small spineless morsel for most of our sports fish. So I think that they're getting eaten up by a lot of the sports fish. And I remember there was a few papers that came out that was kind of attributing the recovery of the freshwater eel to gobies, but just another kind of interesting story about invasive species and how they can
Nature
friends. The base of it all, you know, any invasive species or invasive species event is a bad thing ecologically. There are, you know, like so once they're there, it's very hard to remove them for most types of species in any kind of ecologically friendly way. So the best we can hope for is that they kind of fall into balance. And I'm hoping that's what we're seeing with the lionfish.
So I just have this, so we put out on the For the Reef Instagram, we just put out if anyone had any questions for you. And of course, a ton of questions came in. So I'm just kind of picking one here that I think applies, you know, it applies to most people. So this is coming from Jenna. She says, over the past few years, I've seen a greater amount of people posting pictures on social media of themselves with sharks that they've caught down in Florida while on vacation. I know that catch and release laws are set in place to help preserve shark populations, but to me personally, it seems unnecessary to unintentionally lure and capture sharks out of its home, especially for tourists who are doing this for pleasure and sport. So my question is, how stressful and how harmful is catch and release fishing for sharks in your opinion?
Well, it's a very good question. And it's a quite hot topic at the moment. You know, one of the big concerns in Florida with the catch and release fishing is related to the great hammerheads. There's a pretty large great hammerhead fishery, recreational fishery that has emerged in Florida. And I can see the appeal. They're very, you know, they can get very large. They can be enormous animals. And I'm sure they're very satisfying to, you know, catch and land in terms of that, the idea of fishing them. the amount of stress the animal's under is going to be relative to lots of different factors. One is the actual species of sharks. Some sharks are very, very tough, very hardy. You know, we have to deal with this when we're interacting and manipulating sharks for research. We have to be aware of the different levels of interaction that sharks can cope with before they become, you know, dangerously stressed, where we might do them some damage. Some, as I say, some species incredibly tough, incredibly hardy. Others are very delicate. There's certain physiological aspects about hammerheads that don't lend themselves very well to human interaction and being caught in any manner. So with hammerheads, it's really down to being sensible with the fishery in terms of how you catch them, how you fight them, and how you release them. You know, it's a catch and release fishery, this one. They're protected and they need to be released, but it's really the amount of time that the person spends messing around with the shark, taking the photo, that is going to define the fate of that shark once it is released back into the water. There was a study that suggested a very high mortality rate. I know there's another study currently taking place that is investigating that, or trying to provide more evidence to the actual true mortality rates of those catch and release occurrences with hammerheads. But really, if anyone is, you know, someone who's a shark fisherman or a recreational shark fisherman, the best thing to do is minimize your interaction with them, both in terms of the fight time and the messing around time in releasing them. I understand people want to catch them, and when they catch them, they want to take photos, and everyone's about social media these days. But the minimum time that can be spent, you know, touching or interacting with the shark is ideal. Now, I will, you know, in defense of recreational shark fishing in general, it is another way that sharks can be given value beyond them being harvested, and that in itself is a good thing. If we can demonstrate other value of sharks beyond economic value, I mean beyond harvesting them, one example being shark diving. You know, and there's certain issues with shark diving as well, especially when the sharks are fed. But again, it's pros and cons for everything. That gives great value to shark diving in the Bahamas and gives great value to sharks and a desire to protect those sharks. Similarly, in Florida, you know, recreational shark fishing is an industry, and it's a way that money is provided to local economies through those shark fishermen engaging in that practice. So it's a very fine balance. In an ideal world, everyone would love sharks and, you know, protect them and want to protect them and not, you know, have to physically interact with them to have appreciation of them. But that, you know, the reality is a lot of people, you know, diving with sharks or even fishing sharks really like sharks. They're not intending to do them any harm. So if we can do it in such a way that minimizes the impact to the animal, that's the best of both worlds, I guess.
So I want to extrapolate on that. Before we started recording, just for fun, I asked my son what he would like me to ask the shark man. And he said, does he like the baby shark song? And I thought that was a funny thing, so I'd ask him. But you answered in a way that I didn't expect. And you said, you know, if it teaches kids that we like sharks and sharks are fun and nice, that helps us going forward. To take that one step further, we all, you know, everybody used to look forward to Shark Week every year on TV there, and like, oh, Shark Week, great. And I used to really enjoy it because you would see the guys doing the research and do stuff like that. But lately it feels like it's starting to get sensational again. Do you think that we're swaying away from the fear and the days of Jaws where all sharks must die? And do you think that we're winning that battle in the hearts and minds, or do you think that sort of stuff, when it gets a little sensational, is hurting us again?
You know, I do definitely think the sensational elements can be detrimental and roll back the clock in terms of people's opinions on sharks. So that's never a great thing. But you know, people who watch those shows because they're fascinated by sharks, and some of those people are fascinated because of a fear of sharks, or, you know, a fear of the idea of sharks. And I'd love it if that was used solely as a platform to try and educate people about sharks and you know, the true plight of sharks. But
yeah,
it goes up and down. It goes back and forth, and has done, and probably will continue to do so for us, the Shedd Aquarium, it's a good thing in the sense that it makes everyone's interest about sharks peak, and that gives us a great like doorway to interact with people and, you know, teach them positive things about sharks and shark conservation and management. So for us, it's a good time of year, and you know, everyone's interest in sharks comes a little bit closer to what mine is most of the year round, and I like that. To take that kind of a bit more broadly, I think that overall, at least, you know, in the countries I've lived in, sharks are becoming more popular and in somewhat of a more positive way. When I was a kid, you would never see, or probably very rarely, walk into a clothing store like a Target or something and see loads of kids' clothing with sharks plastered all over them, because people didn't want to associate sharks with their children, because their only idea about sharks and their children is that they might eat their children. Right. Now, clearly that kind of perception has changed. And, you know, some of the positive programming that come out in Shark Week or similar programming has been a benefit. There is still some sensational stuff, and I'd love that not to be the case, but hopefully one day that could be reality. But I think overall since Jaws, the perception has gone in the right direction. Jaws was a dark time. The post Jaws was a pretty dark time for the perception of sharks, and fantastic film, love the film, sure, from a personal level, but had a big detriment to sharks from an opinion and public opinion perspective. But I do think we've made good progress since then. And you know, it's part of my job to, and part of our job as the public aquarium, to continue to change people's opinions.
Okay, on that thread then, so when you're tagging and stuff, do you do it, are you in the water applying tags with sort of like a spear gun and stuff, or are you doing it like the show we see on TV where they have the big deck and they bring them up and tag them like that? And secondary to that, do you find much aggression, or if you act in the appropriate way, do you find they're just checking you out?
Yeah, I've done all of the above of those techniques you've mentioned in at some point in my career. We are regularly, even now, we're regularly in the water with them. And the reality of being in the water with sharks is not what a lot of people would think it is. You know, as I say, I'm lucky enough to get to go and help maintain the shark habitat at Shedd, and we have some pretty sizable animals in there that definitely could do some damage, but they don't, because that's not how a realistic shark human interaction is with those kind of species. Right. That's not to say that it's obviously, we know people have negative interactions with sharks, and there are some fatalities associated with sharks every year globally. It's a very, very low number. You're talking of an average of about 8 people per year in unprovoked attacks that actually lose their lives. So it's an incredibly low number, but obviously the sensationalism around it makes it, you know, front and center when people think about sharks. That's often what they think about. When we research sharks, and what we typically do in the current, under my current research program, is we bring the sharks alongside the boat in a form of restraint, whether that be the smaller tenders, the service boats, to the larger research vessel, or sometimes along the back, there's a dive platform, and we just pull them up alongside that. We're in a good scenario where we can keep them in the water, which has, you know, some benefits, not to say the other technique isn't correct. Mm-hmm. When you interact with the shark in that manner, when you're tagging it, when you're measuring it, when you're putting hands on sharks, they don't like that. They're wild animals, and typically when you grab hold of wild animals, that's not something that they like very much. And as you know, most wild animals, especially bigger wild animals that are able to defend themselves, will try and defend themselves when you interact with them, and you kind of, you know, manipulate them in that manner.
Sure.
The trick is a very healthy respect for them and a lot of experience. It took me many years to where I was comfortable, you know, working with my mentors, to where I could do a lot of the roles within that process. There's several different roles. Some are a little more, you're putting yourself at a little more risk than others. And many more years before I felt comfortable leading a team that I could direct a team to safely work up a shark, process a shark, and from a scientific perspective. Now, you know, I have a lot of experience doing that. I'm very comfortable with the species I work with. If I'm going to be working with a new species, I'll normally seek guidance from someone who may have worked with that species before, because they're all a little different. But the bottom line is, I've been doing this now, as I say, for about 18 years. I've put my hands on many a shark, and to this day, I haven't been bit. And that in itself, if I can do that, if I can if I can manhandle these sharks, if I can, you know, put my hands on them, physically work with them for years and years, where they're in a state of annoyance and defense and not be bit, the chances of your average person, if you don't grab hold of it, you know, free swimming shark or something, the chances that one's going to swim up and bite you is absolutely
right. So minimal, don't appear to be a threat and you won't be a threat, kind of thing.
I'm not saying everyone can swim with sharks all the time and nothing bad will ever happen. It's just using your common sense.
Yeah.
If you're not comfortable, get out the water. Just try and, like most wild animals, try and stay calm. Don't panic. I know it's easier said than done.
But sure.
If you're not comfortable, exit. And if you are comfortable and you think everything's okay, or you're with someone who, you know, has an idea of whether it's okay or not, swimming, you know, with sharks in the right, under the right situations is one of the most amazing things anyone can do.
Yeah. Like I said earlier, I've only ever interacted with one shark, and it was a much more educational and enlightening experience than I thought it was going to be, because I got in the water. We were on the east end of Cayman Islands. I knew there's sharks over there. Never seen one before. You have all the fears, right? You've got to get over your thoughts of Jaws and this and that and the other thing. Yeah. And when I saw that thing, it was just curious. Didn't really care that I was there. And I wanted to get closer, not farther away. And it really surprised me, my reaction and its reaction.
My a good example of this is my brother. He's always been quite susceptible, I feel, to films, in the sense of like gaining opinions from them. And we were on holiday somewhere in the Balearic Islands with the family, and we were on a banana boat. Do you guys call them that? Where they're towed behind a boat and they're kind of,
oh yeah, yeah,
yeah, and you sit on them. And we were quite far offshore. We were in life jackets and everything, and it rolled over. I think I might have encouraged it to roll over because I wanted it to, and I didn't realize the reaction I'd get. And the reaction I got from him was a full-blown panic attack meltdown, because he was convinced that he was instantly going to be eaten by a shark because he had seen Jaws, and that's what sharks do. Then years later, when I started my PhD in Bimini in the Bahamas, my family came out to visit, and I was able to take all of them and get them swimming with reef sharks on, you know, on the reef line there. And he very quickly was comfortable once he saw, you know, obviously I was in first to show him that nothing was gonna happen, but like, well, as soon as he realized that the sharks weren't interested in trying to eat us and they were just there, and you know, as long as you gave them space and were respectful, they were fine. And by the end, he was splashing around, following them around, you know, like,
his
opinion was completely changed. And that's why, you know, things like public aquaria are so powerful. Seeing animals, there's no substitute really for it, seeing animals. Mm-hmm. And if you're lucky enough to do that in the wild, that's amazing. But for many people, that's not the reality. And getting to see animals close up in an aquarium, and, you know, and even, we're not in there every day, but when I see people's eyes get really wide when I'm in that shark habitat helping maintain it, and they see these big sharks and me without, you know, a cage or anything like that, and I see their eyes get really wide and they realize very quickly that, oh, they're not interested.
Yeah, it's that's pretty awesome. Especially, I mean, we were talking earlier about the Georgia Aquarium and all that kind of stuff with diving in those tanks. But it's just funny. It's funny how this conversation has kind of led itself into talking about people's perception of sharks and stuff, because we had two young people who are interested in marine biology and are just fascinated by nature in general. So I just have two questions here, and it's funny that we're talking about the perception of sharks, because this first one is from Maya. She's only 7 years old, and here's her question to you, Steve.
Are some sharks nice?
Are some sharks nice?
Are some sharks nice?
I love the question. I personally think all sharks are nice. I think they're all fantastic. But so I guess what you could say is different types of sharks might broadly have a different temperament, and some sharks are quite docile and others are a bit more predatory, you know, depending on what they eat. You know, it's a little bit Fisher Friends from Finding Nemo. Unfortunately, there are no like truly vegetarian sharks. All sharks are carnivores of some description. But as I say, some of their temperaments are definitely a little mellower, and so, some sharks are quite lazy. You know, some sharks are swimming around all the time looking for the next meal. Others just like to chill out. You know, they'll eat a meal every now and again. They like to just lay there. If you come to shed, you'll see some of our Wobbegong sharks who just, you know, chill out on the bottom all the time, and they're very placid.
Yeah,
but I think all sharks are nice personally, but
yeah, and that's so I'll convey that. I'll make sure that Maya gets that message that all sharks are nice. Actually, it's funny. Any and all of my interactions with sharks when diving has been, you know, they, depending on what they were, some seemed to just be scared and had, you know, not even scared, but just moving away from me. And then I had others that were just completely not interested in me at all. They had zero interest in what I was doing or anything like that. So it is funny when you get, you know, down eye level with them, that changes your perception.
I saw a shark, I was it was about 20 years ago, I was at the Great Barrier Reef snorkeling, and I kind of drifted away from the broader group because I was so fascinated by the barrier reef, and that is not an advisable thing to do. That was not good practice when I was younger then. And a white-tip reef shark, a fairly sizable white-tip reef shark, maybe a couple of meter, 180, 2 meter reef shark, swam right underneath me. And it was not at all. It just wasn't interested. It wasn't scared of me, but it absolutely wasn't interested in me. But I do remember feeling my heart, you know, beating really fast. And I did quite quickly find my way back to the group.
Yeah.
And I, you know, really, but now I have so much more experience. You know, I recognize that wasn't.
Sure.
And I took a photo of it. I was very, with the disposable camera, I was very fascinated, but I was also not confident enough at that time to be alone quite far from everyone else when that guy was swimming around.
Right. And then so one last fun little question here from Ryder, 5 years old. Here's his question.
Why do sharks have sharp teeth?
Okay, why do sharks have sharp teeth? Well, again, the relative sharpness of their teeth is very variable by species. But they often rely, they don't have hands. So when they feed, and when they eat, especially if they're eating something that they can't swallow whole and they need to, you know, maybe break it up, they don't have the ability to hold it and use their hands to kind of work against their teeth. So they rely on having very sharp teeth that they can, you know, move their body around and that will collectively act as like a saw and break through their food and put it off. But they are able to keep their teeth sharp because they have new teeth coming through all the time. If evolution, if we evolved directly from sharks, a lot of dentists would be out of work because they have rows and rows of teeth that come forward. And as soon as one falls out, a new one will very quickly pop forward and keep them. And that keeps them nice and sharp. So over the course, you know, as I said, they're very long lived. Some of them could live 50, 100 years. If they had the same teeth, they get kind of blunt over time, but they're able to keep them nice and pointy by changing them out on a regular basis.
Yeah, that's so awesome. Well, thanks a lot, Steve. It's really been great catching up with you and talking to you on here. And we really, really appreciate you taking your time out of tonight to listen or to speak on the podcast. And so Ian, before I wrap things up, I don't know if you had any kind of final questions or anything.
Well, before we got cut off, we had some audio problems earlier. We're going to edit out that most people won't hear, but I heard you guys start making a few comments about dolphins and stuff, and I kind of felt like there was a story there.
I think I know where Mitch is going with this, I thought I'd escape that by the technical difficulties. Sorry, go on, Mitch. I think this relates to a presentation I gave back in Windsor several years ago.
Oh.
Yeah, all right, we'll do the backstory. you thought you were going to be saved by technical difficulties. Back in the day, when I was with the Windsor Aquarium Society, and, you know, it's just a small group of guys that are interested in the in aquariums, and we kind of just nerd out and get together every once in a while and talk about our love for the aquariums. And it's a really small, you know, humble group. And we asked Steve to come and do a presentation, and he was gracious enough to show up and give us a presentation, and it was awesome. And I remember one thing that you said at that presentation was your I don't know how to say it, that you didn't necessarily love dolphins. And I wonder if you could elaborate on that a little bit.
Yeah, well, I love all of Earth's creatures equally, but sharks a little more. Yeah. But there's a kind of funny thing. It's a little bit of a, I don't know how to really describe it. It's almost like liking a sports team, okay? Yeah. And sharks are my sports team and dolphins are kind of the rival sports team, the sharks. So if you speak to a lot of shark biologists, they'll be, you know, a little tongue-in-cheek negative about dolphins because there's almost like rivalry between dolphins and sharks and dolphin researchers and shark researchers. I like a lot of marine animals, and but the disdain is, as I say, it's largely tongue-in-cheek because of that kind of perceived rivalry between shark like, people and dolphin people.
Just the like only other... go Tottenham.
Yeah.
Oh, damn. Mitch is, for listener, Mitch is ragging on me because I'm an Arsenal fan. And that's so if Arsenal were the Sharks, Tottenham's might be the Dolphin.
Gotcha.
And I'm happy with that. I'm happy with that.
The only other question I can think of at the risk of straying towards the sensational a little bit would be, do you think, you know, I mean, I'm sure there's things out there we haven't discovered. Do you think there's a super sized shark out there that you haven't seen yet?
So like in reference to the Megalodon, are you asking me if I think Megalodons still exist or if there's
or anything of a larger scale than we're aware of? Is there evidence to point to that?
I would say that megalodons absolutely do not exist anymore. They were a very real animal, but they became extinct about 3 million years ago. And there was the film where they were hiding down a deep trench. That wouldn't be feasible. They're a surface associated animal. They're very similar in ecology from what we can understand to the great white. And there's just no way an animal of that size would have been able to avoid avoid detection in the shallow water. You know, if you think about how many boats are currently out on the ocean right now, these were big surface predators, you know, that hit things on the surface. There's no way. There are some really large species of shark down in the deep ocean. Greenland sharks, there's people that believe they could get very, very large, and we don't really know what the biggest one might be. Six gill sharks, they can be very large as well. So it's possible that there are really, really big individuals of those species that we haven't yet found and we don't yet understand how large they get. It's also possible that there is a species that we haven't discovered yet that could also be large. But again, this would be a non-surface associated animal that would live, you know, primarily down in the deep ocean. Mm. Typically, as I said, we find new species of shark every year, about six or seven or so.
It's always interesting to think what could still be out there, you know?
You know, it's funny you were asked that question. I'm like, of course, this is going to be an easy answer. And Steve comes out with like some thought provoking answer.
but you never know.
Yeah.
Oh, you, for sure. You never know. You know, never say never. And that could be. This would not be of any threat to people. You know, this would not be a shark that people are going to interact with.
Yeah. I was just visualizing this, you know, the megalodon at the surface. I never even like visualized that. And it would just.
No.
Well, so I'd really like to believe as an avid fan of the Life Aquatic that there is a jaguar shark down there somewhere.
Yeah.
Hanging out with the Kraken and all the other things.
Yeah, exactly. Sweet. Okay. Well, you know, we don't want to push your time too much.
No, really, thanks very much, Steve.
Yep. Really, really appreciate it,
well,
Steve.
It's been a real pleasure. You know, it's a nice, like, this isn't work for me getting to talk about sharks. It's one of my favorite things to do. I would ramble on forever. And, you know, I really appreciate you guys having me on. I look forward to hearing it. If you guys are ever, you know, back in Chicago when the world is a more normal place, definitely hit me up.
Absolutely.
I'll show you around the aquarium. And
that'd be great.
Any listeners are listening and they're in the area, make Shed Aquarium a priority when you're in the Midwest, because it really is a fantastic organization. Obviously, mildly biased, but I swear to God, I would say that if I didn't work there even.
Yeah, and I was on their website today. You can even enjoy the Shed Aquarium now. I noticed that they had some live cams of the tanks.
Yeah, and they have some virtual experiences as well, virtual shark feeds and things like that. So, you know, if you're really stuck for something to do, it's a really great way. Me and my friend's kid did a virtual otter encounter for his birthday, and he was made up. Like, it's really great. Some really great programs there, even now.
Yeah, that's really cool. Okay, so just to kind of tie everything up, as we always mentioned, you can contact us at fortthereefpodcast@gmail.com. You can always find myself at For the Reef, Ian at Sustainable Marine Canada on any of your social media platforms. And as always, we encourage everyone to check out the Shedd Aquarium, Cayman Eco Divers, Seacore International, all of these great nonprofit organizations that are doing amazing stuff. With that, thanks again, Steve, and till next time.
Take it easy, guys.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the For the Reef podcast. As always, you can reach us at fortthereefpodcast@gmail.com or via our websites, fortthereef.com or sustainablemarinecanada.ca. If you would like to get involved and help the reef restoration efforts, check out our friends at caymanecodivers.com. We hope you enjoyed today's podcast. Please hit subscribe and join us for the next episode coming soon.